Our guest has studied urban anthropology. He worked in government planning before getting elected himself as a councilman in Canada's capital city, Ottawa. Clive Doucette has worked tirelessly for livable cities and public transit. Clive, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be here with you, Alex.
I'd like to take a second to explain why I called. Well, over a year ago, I heard and recorded you here in Vancouver at the launch of your book, Urban Meltdown, Cities, Climate Change, and Politics as Usual. You surprised me then with the idea that cities don't always grow, and in fact, some may experience a meltdown. You know, at the time, Clive, I have to admit, I was thinking everlasting growth, and I didn't really believe it would get that serious. But now I'm seeing amateur video reports on YouTube of cities and towns floundering and places closing and some with empty blocks or even burned out buildings. Why is this happening?
Well, I think it's because of climate change and resource shortages, basically. If you think about the old adage, it's always been the go west, young man, go west, and make your fortune there. And successive waves of Canadians and Americans have drifted west, and they do to this day, where the skies are bluer and the more resources and the more opportunity. And so when there was a decline in the eastern cities, or the eastern cities stopped growing, there was this safety valve which people just moved to another city. And it's happening to this day. I mean, if you look at the great growing cities of North America, they're all in the west. Boulder, Colorado, Denver, Portland, Vancouver, Seattle. You look in the east and you see cities that are not growing at all. Halifax, Philadelphia, a lot of them are declining. And if they're not declining, they're probably growing in not a very healthy way, like Toronto, where they're getting really surviving on massive immigration of very, very cheap labor. And it's not a healthy growth. As I thought about this, I thought, well, what will happen if the climate change predictions are correct? That the New Orleans and the Philadelphias and the Detroits are not going to become the exceptions. They will become more and more the norm. Eventually, you're going to see a clear line of demarcation between cities that are producing basically refugees, which has never really happened in North America in anyone's memory, and cities that become refuge cities like Vancouver.
Well, you talk about refugee cities, and I think of the example of people dispersed from New Orleans. They went all over the country after Hurricane Katrina. What are some of the other refugee cities that come to mind?
Well, some of them are really surprising. I was invited very fortunately to a conference in Philadelphia in November, just 2 days after Barack Obama's election, and it was very exciting to going down, and it was an exciting conference too. It was sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation and the University of Pennsylvania School of Urban Design, and it was to celebrate a conference they had run there with the Rockefeller Foundation 50 years earlier, when they had young Jane Jacobs, prior to her publishing her famous book, A Decline and Fall, Death and Life of Great American Cities, Lewis Mumford, etc. And so it was to celebrate this, mark this first conference. And I arrived excited to be there and to meet the other conferences. But when I got off the plane, the front page of the paper was not Barack Obama, believe it or not. It was the mayor of Philadelphia, and he was announcing their budget. And he was announcing $1 billion in cuts. They were closing 11 local libraries mostly in the poorest parts of the city. They were closing 68, pools, you know, swimming pools for children. They were closing fire stations. And that was all over. And Barack wasn't there at all. And I looked at this and I thought to myself, my God, what's going on? Well, what's going on was the city was melting down. And Philadelphia is a rich city with a rich history, an optimistic city. It's the home of world champion baseball and football teams, and yet there it was. They weren't unable to run their city, and And I think you're seeing that in Detroit, in spades. Detroit is half the population it was 20 years ago. It's less than 1 million. It used to be more than 2 million. You're seeing it in Cleveland, and you're seeing it, you're starting to see it in some Canadian cities.
Well, the national government seems at the same time to be broke and somewhat immobile. Is there a network of conversation at these local levels about how to handle what is really an emergency?
I don't think there is. I think cities are the North American and the Western, especially the North American equivalent of underdeveloped countries. You hear a lot about the travails of African nations and African cities and Asian cities. Nothing ever really gets done about it. It's sort of, oh, it's the global south, they're poor, we're rich, you know. And that's the end of the story. And you send a little aid and via an NGO, but nothing structurally ever really changes to alleviate their difficulties. Same thing with cities. Cities, if you're elected to a local city council, whether it's quite a big city like my city, what you quickly find out is, as a councillor, you're kind of like a bit like a short order chef in a really cheap restaurant. You know, you've got you always have 10 things burning on the stove, and you keep running from one to the other just to stop them from burning, and so you can get some of them served out to your customers, you know, in the appropriate way. Your time to do the big things that need to be done to change what's making you run from one cheap dish to another never gets done. And I'll give you an example. The mayor of Toronto, David Miller, a couple of years ago started a campaign for the 1 cent now, and 1 cent now of the GST. And his proposition was the federal government should take 1% of the GST and not cut it, but send it directly to cities across the country. And that would have sent to my city $180 million, I think, every year. Well, $180 million is our shortfall. It's the difference between us being able to meet all our needs and being constantly without enough funds. What happened? The federal government cut 1% of the GST, which they figured they didn't need or they could get along without, and we were unable. The mayors and councils of across the country were unable to generate any kind of national campaign to get people to understand how important this was. You know, consider that the federal government, both in the United States and Canada, gets about 50% of your tax dollars. The province gets 48%. The cities, where 60% of your services, most of them essential, you can't live without them, do it on 8 cents on your dollar. That's how little we get. And that 1 cent of the GST meant nothing to the federal government, meant the difference between life and death for cities. I arranged the first march on Parliament Hill ever from the city. We passed a motion to City Council. Half of City Council was Ottawa, which is, you know, a fairly conservative town. We marched on Parliament Hill demanding 1% of the GST in the depths of winter in a snowstorm. And I got a call from David, said, gee, that was great, Clive. You got some attention on the national media. I said, okay, what do we do next? And he said, I've got to run right now. I've got a crisis on Front Street. And that was the last I heard from him. And it's typical of what happens right across the country. You've got city councils who cannot mount the national campaigns necessary to change the environment in which we live.
And even more serious in the United States, where so many, the municipalities, their tax base is shrinking, their bonds are not being rated very well, some of them didn't invest well, you have big deficits, huge deficits, they're having to cut down fire services and police even. I'm wondering, will some cities and towns become unworkable and maybe even be abandoned?
Well, I think that's happening right now with a lot of cities, that the Rust Belt in the States, but one of the, you know, it's going on as we speak. The danger, I think, though, is trying to say, well, it's a specific cause. It's happening because Detroit. It's clear why it's happening there. The American auto industry is melting down. Okay, why is it happening in Philadelphia? Why is it happening in Cleveland? Why is it happening in Scranton? Why is it happening in New Orleans? Why is it happening in some Floridian towns?
And Phoenix, and Las Vegas.
In Phoenix, you start to say maybe this isn't an exceptional occurrence. What you're seeing is a common thread, is that cities can no longer afford to be cities. And they can no longer afford to be cities because the economic pillars of, you know, of which they depended upon have shrunk, and they can be, they're different in every place, but the common theme is they've all shrunk, and they cannot grow the way they used to grow. They used to roll out asphalt and cement, it was a piece of cake, it was a, now the cost of rolling out your asphalt and repairing your roads is, because of resource shortages and price increases, is unaffordable for most municipalities. We invested $20 million more in road repair than last year than we did the previous year, and we repaired 20% less. Well, what do you think that means is happening to your city? It means every road is becoming more, not every, but your roads are becoming more pitted and pockmarked and less travelable every year. And that's the kind of crunch every city is in. And what happens when your city doesn't provide adequate services, and it has a knock-on effect? Pretty soon people don't want to live there, and if they don't want to live there, they pick up and go somewhere else. And so you're seeing enormous influxes of people to places like Vancouver and Boulder, Colorado, and Portland, who've become kind of lighthouse cities which people are fleeing to. But the great danger is they're going to be overcome, because the only way to solve this problem is you've got to make all of those cities livable, not just sort of do what we've always done, which is we'll cut your losses. Well, Philadelphia doesn't work anymore, no problem, we'll move west.
Yeah, but you know, Oregon is having big troubles with unemployment, very high unemployment, and here in Vancouver we've had the economy stalling, we've got a glut of unsold new condos, and a big hotel project abandoned as a hole in the ground downtown. I'm wondering, have we just hit an unexpected limit to the idea of cities?
I think what's happened is limits to growth has finally hit in. If you remember back in 1974, there was a report signed on by most of the leaders of the Western world, including the Prime Minister of Canada at the time, Trudeau, saying we cannot have a world in forever which is based on limitless growth, that sooner or later that growth is going to smack up against limited resources. We cannot have infinite growth in a finite world. And I think at the time, back in 1974, people regarded it like E equals MC squared. You know, it was sort of an interesting theory, and it probably was true, but it had no effect on my life. And people kind of, if they read about it, they filed it under that E equals MC squared kind of thought. The trouble is, that was, what, 40 years ago, and now it's coming true, and it's affecting all of our lives. And if we want to continue to be healthy and secure, we have to have healthy, secure cities, because 80% of Canadians and Americans basically live in cities. And the only way you can create secure, safe cities is they have to be based on a sustainable model. In other words, you have to be able to, the taxes you raise have to pay for the services you need. And that's never been the case in any city in North America. The way we fund and make ourselves wealthy is we are constantly borrowing against growth. That's how we develop all our suburbs. We borrow money against anticipated growth. For every dollar of services we put out there, it costs us $1.40 for every dollar of taxes we raise, it costs $1.40 to provide the services. Well, how do we make up that 40-cent gap? We finance it through anticipated growth. Well, you take away that anticipated growth, and what happens? You collapse, because 40 cents is what? That's close to 30% of your needs every year are shortfalled if you stop growing. So what you have to do is you have to retrofit your cities to actually not grow, but to return enough revenue so you can constantly reinvest in the services you need. Because even if you're not growing, a city requires massive reinvestment every year. Every year you've got to reinvest in your pipes and your sewers and your roads and your transit, and it can be done. The good news is it can be done. You look at the Lewis line in Dublin, electric rail line, It returned a $6.6 million euro surplus in its second year of operation. You can create city services which actually pay for themselves. You cannot, in a non-growth economy, afford to be building high-volume roads that are 100% dependent upon growth revenues.
We are talking with author and politician Clive Doucette. Let's get to the politics-as-usual part of your book. I'm concerned we're moving into uncharted territory here. For example, we only count the homeless every few years, and governments have stopped building public housing. The old models of how to cope could get drowned by a wave of unemployed people whose benefits and credit have run out. Are we at the brink of a major social change here, do you think, for our cities and towns?
I think we are, and what's going to distinguish the cities that are going to do relatively well from those who don't are the ones that are able to make the shift towards a sustainable landscape and a sustainable economy. It's very difficult when you've been doing something for 60 years one way to make that shift. Is hard, and the thing is, I know Vancouver and Portland have their difficulties now, just as every other city does. But you compare Vancouver to say Ottawa. We in Vancouver, you have not built a new road in 20 years inside the city, and you have a transit system which is actually diminishing the number of people on your roadways. In my city, we're growing our city by 200 kilometers of new road every year, and we're adding 125 to 50 million dollars worth of new operating costs every year. It's totally unsustainable. You know, I've been to Vancouver and I've been on your transit system. The really neat thing was your transit planner took me on a system, and he said, "Well, we'll just use the system." And we were able to travel around your whole city, and we just moved from one level of transit to another without any real inconvenience. You have no idea how magical that is compared to, say, a city like Ottawa, which has 1,000 buses on the road every day, but all we've got is buses, nothing else but buses, and it basically is a rush hour service. It you cannot move around the city easily just using a bus. If I brought someone here, it would be tempting to take them by a car. You know, that's the kind of, you know, lighthouse hope that initiatives like Vancouver have made that remind the rest of us that we can change.
Well, with their backs to the wall now, for those cities that look like they could be viable, if you could speak to the mayors and the councils, what would you be recommending?
I would recommend to them that they have to think about retrofitting their cities, and that means investing in it in an entirely different way. They've got to build neighborhoods which are self-sustaining. Like, cities are composed of neighborhoods, and you have to start your sustainability from the neighborhood level up. You've got to create neighborhoods where people want to live, work, and play, so that collectively those neighborhoods form like little blocks of Lego. Together they form your city, and your city is strong. If you have neighborhoods that are not self-sustaining, then what happens is they're constantly poaching off another neighborhood or a different part of the city, and you've got an unsustainable cycle going on. That's what you see in most cities, and in the past we have been able to paper over it by this tremendous growth most cities have felt. I mean, Ottawa, for example, like most Canadian cities, is twice the size it was when I was a child. It's now almost 1 million people, and it was, when I was a child, it was about 400,000 people. But it covers a landscape which is 5 or 6 times as big. People take up way more room. So what we've done in the last 50 years is we've created a much bigger city with much bigger demands, but it's much more costly to run, and it's much less sustainable. Our food now, it used to come when I was a boy, we had dairies in the city, we had bakeries in the city, a large part of our food supply came from the Ottawa Valley, which is a broad and fertile valley, now come from Vancouver or from, you know, the southern United States, which is kind of crazy, but that's what we've got. So when you can see the fragility of the city building when instead of having these local strengths and these independent neighborhoods that kind of provide for themselves, you more and more are dependent upon these great big umbilical services. The local grocer in one of the neighborhoods that I represent can tell you when the 18-wheel trailer is leaving from Vancouver for his store in Ottawa. That's really scary, because it means that umbilical cord ever gets severed or changed, and the cost structure gets changed, suddenly life gets much more expensive, much more difficult in this town. So I think politicians have to wake up and realize that all the things that they used to do are not going to work, and start to think about doing things in a way that's going to create these sustainable cities.
We have been talking with Councilman Clive Doucette in Ottawa, Canada. His latest book is Urban Meltdown, Cities, Climate Change, and Politics as Usual. Closing out, Clive, what could the average person do to learn more about this or even help heal this crisis?
I think connect with your local city council and really understand what they're doing and more importantly what they're not doing, and insist on change. The great thing about local politics is it should be at your door. You should be able to talk to your local councilwoman or man and say, you know, we want to do things differently. And if we can lead at the local level, the federal and the state and the provinces will follow. But it's going to take leadership from the local level. I don't think we're going to see it from the upper levels, because it's too much to their advantage. No one wants to give up power, and the federal governments of the nations of North America have had an unequal share of the tax base for centuries, since their formation. So why are they going to give that up? They're only going to give it up if the local councils change the way they spend their money and change their demands. And we as citizens can have that effect if we get engaged at that level.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it, Clive.
A real pleasure. And, where there's life, there's always hope.
Okay, and I'm going to point people to your website, too, clivedoucette.com, spelled D-O-U-C-E-T. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.